Radio Vermont, WDEV, takes no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by the House Calls Vermont show host or their guests. The information provided during the House Calls Vermont show is offered only as a public service and should not be used as a substitute for obtaining any professional advice from a licensed professional.
Our house, in the middle of our street, our house.
WDEV presents House Calls Vermont with hosts Jim Bradley and Chris West. Each week, a new topic specific to building or renovating in the Green Mountains. And your phone calls, brought to you by RK Miles, a third-generation family-owned business, proud to be your local building material supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years known for anything construction, big or small jobs, one call does it all, POLLIconstruction.com. Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor, 802-793-2002. Curtis Lumber with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. Sticks and Stuff in Swanton Lumber with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com. Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems for all things basement-y, northernnefoundations.com. Wytha Windows, high-performance passive house windows and doors, online at wythewindows.com. Your participation is encouraged. Call the listener line with questions at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Right now, House Calls Vermont with Jim and Chris.
Good morning, good afternoon.
Just afternoon.
Exactly. Well, it depends on what part of the country we're in. But as of right now, good afternoon. Welcome to House Calls Vermont. Our listeners returning and new. I'm here myself, Jim Bradley, with Chris West.
How's it going, guys?
And this week, we're going to be touching on a topic, or really diving in deep to a topic, about renewables. And one of the renewables that is very prolific throughout the nation and the world is solar arrays.
Photovoltaics.
Yes, and so we're going to be talking about that. We're going to have a guest on after our first break, Marcus Shapiro with Green Mountain Solar. He's going to be on to explain what how they look at things with their business, but also give us some more insights on some of the rebates that are available for Vermonters and what, some of the things you should consider before getting into solar.
Net metering, all those types of questions. If you're going to be investing a chunk of money, because in order to power your house completely or even to offset part, it's not a small investment. But it is a very good long-term investment,
yes,
which is why a lot of people are getting into it. But before we dive into the topic today, we just want to throw out, first of all, the number 802-244-1777. Give us a call. If you have a question about a renovation you're working on, if you're noticing issues with your house right now that we're dealing. So Jim and I sometimes talk about shoulder season. This is classic shoulder
exactly.
season. We are hovering between freezing temperatures and above freezing temperatures. And you're going to see things happening during a shoulder season that you may not see at other times of year. And that's take notice. Once again, I'm going to recommend that you all, if you're having questions about the comfort or durability, about mold or mildew in your house, about the health of the people in your house, write a journal. Keep your House Calls Vermont journal. Write down what it is, when it happens, what the outside conditions are, and we can start to build some data to understand what might be going on with your house. But on that point, the indoor air quality survey that we're doing here through House Calls Vermont, we are getting our first two monitors out this week. And after that, we'll be going through the list. We've got about 10 or 12 of you who are interested in participating, and we will be cycling those through. It'll take about a couple of months to get through everybody with the monitors we have. So if you haven't yet signed up and are interested in participating in our survey, just a quick overview, where you'll if you participate, you'll be getting one of these IQ Air monitor systems with a piece of paper. That piece of paper will let us track where you're putting that monitor in your house. You leave it in a particular place for 48 hours. You move it to another room for 48 hours. And oftentimes we're asking you to change the condition. So if you're putting it in a bedroom, we want you to do one night with the bedroom door open, one night with the bedroom door closed. Then the third night, again with the door open and then with the door closed, so we can get a different reading based on different outside weather conditions. And so if you're still interested, give us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com, and we'll put you on the list to participate in the survey.
And today, once again, should you be considering having solar panels put on your home or at your property or whatever? You've been thinking about it. You've had questions about it. What are the pluses? What are the minuses? What are the things you need to consider about, hey, does my roof support this? Do I need a new roof prior to putting these on? Things like that.
What's my orientation like? Should I put solar panels on a north-facing roof? Things like that.
But certainly. But, you know, go ahead and call in 802-244-1777 with those questions. And we can definitely help you out with those today. You know, the effects of the solar, you know, the benefits of solar have been around as long as the sun has, of course. And so with that, though, humankind has only been able to capture that, though, not for as long, you know.
So an interesting fact.
Yep.
The Earth on a sunny day gets enough energy in one day from the sun to power all of our super energy intensive things for like 10,000 years. It's that we can't capture that and turn it into – now, we do capture it. We grow food.
Sure.
Growing food is capturing sunlight. We turn that – we use the photosynthesis, and we turn that into food. We use that food to feed our other animals that we also eat. So we've been capturing sunlight for a very long time and using that. But we haven't been capturing it to turn it into electricity for very long.
Yeah, definitely. And with that, when you talk about the efficiency of a system, and that's something people wonder, how efficient is a solar system? So when someone says, well, currently it's about a 20 to 22% efficiency. Well, that doesn't seem very high. Well, it's, to put it in a better perspective, that's about how much usable energy that we can garner from the suns, from the photons that are coming from the sun in the visible light spectrum, and turn that or convert that into energy that's usable, or electricity into the house. So that's what we're talking about there. And different cells, solar cells, have different abilities. The one that's been around the longest has been the silicone base cell. And new technologies are coming out, and we'll get into those, that are going to be more efficient. But there's a limit on how far that efficiency can go, because even if you have a cell that's very, very efficient, it only can usually capture certain wavelengths of the light spectrum that comes from the sun, and so it can't be completely efficient.
Yeah. Well, we've got a caller right now. We're going to Marcia in Cabot. Marcia, good morning. Good afternoon. How can we help you?
Good morning. We're doing a renovation and are considering an air-to-water heat pump, and can't find out too much about them, and wondered if you had an opinion about them, and also the differences between putting the radiant tubing in the floor, ceiling, or walls?
Those are great questions. I'll jump in on that. So air-to-water heat pumps are a very good way to efficiently turn a colder fluid water into a warmer fluid water. The companies out there that produce air-to-water heat pumps include Sandin. That's a pretty well-known one that has been around for about 10 or 15 years. And the larger companies, your Mitsubishis, your Daikins, and your Fujitsus, are starting to put these out as well. And there are some American companies that do that. And the reason that we like using them is because, of course, of the high efficiencies with them. Mm-hmm. So on the what kind of unit can you find out there? Sandin is a place to look. But I would also contact an HVAC expert who specializes in heat pumps to ask them what these other larger companies like LG Mitsubishi, Fujitsu have available. So I'd start there. Where should I put my radiator? right? Because we have two bits to this. The first bit is what are we using to make the warm water, and the second is what's better, floor heating or ceiling heating or column heating. There are a couple of different options to do with that. And the first thing is you cannot use relatively low water temperatures for regular radiators, right? Part of the radiator calculation is the area of the radiator surface times and the temperature of the water flowing into that. So if we have a radiant baseboard system, we're going to have 190 degree temperature water running to that radiator, and the return is about 170, and there's no way that an air source heat pump, whether that's air to air or air water, can produce that. So you're looking at temperatures between usually 100 degrees and 130 degrees, relatively cool water, but your radiator is really big. It's the whole floor or the whole ceiling. And so that's the beginning of the discussion about what is the best place to go. Mm-hmm. The second one is radiant floors are great systems, but radiant floors are 60% radiant and 40% convective, which means that the floor is radiating out. So if you can look at the floor, you're getting heat. But it's also heating some of the air in that room, and that air is going up, and that then again we have the stack effect, which we're constantly talking about. So radiant floors are, but the nice thing about radiant floors is they're really well known, right? We really know how to do a good radiant floor, although you have to be very careful about if you're putting a radiant floor in the joist bay of a floor, expecting to heat the floor above it. You have to watch out for, don't put rugs on top of them, because that's insulative and it's going to mean that the heat isn't getting out into the room very well. You can't put a lot of furniture over it because you're blocking, once again, that radiative part of it. Mm-hmm. The other option is, as you mentioned, is radiant ceilings. Now, radiant ceilings as a concept is relatively new. A lot of HVAC specialists are kind of wary about it because they don't know it. But radiant ceilings are great because you have the same surface area as your floor, but you're never going to put a rug on your ceiling. So you're not going to be reducing the efficiency of that by putting furniture or something like that. And the nice thing about radiant ceilings is that they are 100% radiant heating, right? There's no air above it to heat to create a convective pathway. So I'm a big fan of the radiant ceiling system, but there aren't many people in Vermont who are comfortable installing that.
But one quick question, Chris, that I have for you on that is, because would this be more effective if you have a two-story or a unit for the radiant floor in the ceiling? Or because if you get into the attic and you get to that thermal barrier, would the insulation blanket, if you will, be enough to still make it work efficiently? Because I still know that we've seen those old electric resistance heaters
right
in the ceilings, and then they would put a little bit of insulation on top, which I cannot stand whatsoever.
No.
So,
what so it's very that? Important if you're going, even if you're doing a floor system or a radiant ceiling system, that the area above or below, if it's a floor system below and if it's a ceiling system above, is well insulated. So you're creating a pathway for the heat to go. So if you can do a radiant ceiling on the second floor, you want to make sure you've got 20 inches of insulation above
sure
it, so that the heat has more of a propensity to go down than up. So those are my thoughts on radiant ceilings and radiant floors. The house that I'm renovating right now, I'm planning on installing radiant ceilings. They have to be well designed. Right, you have to make sure that the person who's designing knows what they're doing, because there are different patterns of loops in the floor. Do you do more loops by the outside walls and fewer loops as you come into the house? Those are all considerations that have to be looked at.
Okay, great, good. And do you have any idea, like, the kilowatt hours? Like, we do have solar panels,
okay,
so that's
okay
one reason we're considering this.
Yeah.
How many kilowatt hours you need in order to run one of these for a normal size house?
That's a very good question. Yes, there is a way to do that.
Yeah.
Basically, what you need to do is find out what the load is on your house, mm-hmm, right? How much heat your house is losing at that minimum temperature. And then you have to figure out, over a year, if you're not making other changes to your house while you're doing this, right, so that we have a static kind of house situation, if you know how much fuel you're using right now to heat your house, and you know the efficiency of the unit you're using, we can figure out how much energy you're using overall. Then we can take, once we have that overall energy use for your house, we can look at the efficiency of that heat pump hot water heater, that air to water heat pump that we're talking about, and find out how much energy that needs to produce the hot water that your new radiant ceiling system will need. So there's a bit that has to go into it, but it certainly is based on past fuel usage. Like I said, if you're not changing other things with the house, then you could probably take that as a pretty good bet as to what your usage is.
And Marcia, again, I would say, as we said so many times before, when you're looking to go towards a new heating system and you're trying to find out what that load is historically, or you're going to renewables if you already got solar, it is so important to look at the house as a system first and make sure that you've made those weatherization changes that you plan to make, decreasing the load that's required in the house first and foremost to make sure that the system operates as optimally as possible.
So ideally, I hate to say this, but ideally, having an energy audit done, having retrofits done to your house before you buy this system and have it installed, and live in it for a while to find out what the new load is. Although that can be calculated. I'm not saying you have to wait a year, but one way to get really good data is to wait a year. Depends on how anxious you are to get it done, how interested you are, and how quickly you want to get it done. If you're okay with it's going to take a year, then we could look at that other way. Other way is to do model, which is something that we also can do to find out with the new measures what your new usage would be and size the new system accordingly.
Yep. Okay, great. Thank you. I have one more question.
Okay.
I've been told about climate panels for, I think that's what they call them, for putting radiant heat in the floor.
I'm not aware of that term, climate panels. I'll take a look at that. Can you send me an email about that? I'd be happy to dive in deeper.
Okay.
Into that.
Great. Good. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. You're very welcome. Thank you very much. That was a great phone call. We're a little past our break, so we're going to go right to our break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Marcus Shapiro, but we also have a call on the line. John, please hold on.
Christmas Eve Then and Now by Wythe Windows. Christmas Eve Then.
And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
Tighten up that kerchief. It's going to be a cold one.
It's that nasty draft from the window that's to blame.
Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash.
Hurry, I think I see something.
It's stuck.
And Christmas Eve Now.
Look, it's Santa. What a clear, unobstructed view we get through our Wythe windows. Quick, tilt it open.
Hey, Santa, it's Jim.
Those are some good-looking Wythe tilt-and-turn windows.
I know. 8 locking points keep them air and watertight, and they're made in New Jersey.
That's my next stop. I have a new guitar for the boss.
I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight.
Wythe windows for all, for a house cozy and tight.
Wythe windows, high-performance passive house windows and doors. Online at WYTHEWindows.com.
Welcome back to House Calls Vermont. I'm Jim Bradley here with my friend and colleague, Chris West.
How's it going, guys?
We have another call real quick. John in Middlesex, who says he has experience with radiant ceilings, and we have a few minutes before our guest comes on. So, John, go ahead with your input.
Hi. I'm an architect, and many years ago, we put in some electric radiant ceiling panels. They used to sell it at the lumber yard.
Sure.
It was before electricity became evil or we were aware of energy efficiency issues. And one of the things that happened was that when you sat at the dining room table, the heat did not get to your feet. Your head was warm, but your feet were cold.
Yep.
So we thought that was not good and shifted to floor radiant, which never found anybody that wasn't thrilled with. And one of the reasons it's worked so well is that you mentioned stratification.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like the floor is always warmer than the air, so you can't possibly have cold feet that way. And it's much better to have your feet warm than your head warm. So beware.
Understood.
To get your experience when you
don't get
your
cold feet.
Radiant, there's comfort issues that we were not expecting to see, but we're quite noticeable.
Fascinating. Yeah, that would make sense because your radiant ceiling is being blocked by your table, right? So your floors under the table are not getting radiant. I do have another is your house super insulated?
At the time, no.
Okay. Yeah, I think that will have an effect. The houses that I've heard that have the radiant ceilings in them that are super insulated and super airtight have not been making those complaints. So it may have to do with peak loads and infiltration also adding to the fact that the radiant ceiling couldn't keep up necessarily with the load loss. But thank you, John, for calling and sharing your experience with us.
Yep. Good luck with your experimentation.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, right now we have a guest. We have Marcus Shapiro with Green Mountain Solar. And Green Mountain Solar is a company that I became aware of about 4 years ago when the owner, Paul Lejeur, I did an energy home performance assessment at his home. And I just started hearing about some of the methodologies that he employed, his passions towards renewables and everything else and his outlook. And I thought it was great. And Chris, he's an honest broker. He definitely does an excellent job. The customers that I've done energy audits for and home performance assessments, and sitting across one right now, Chris West, he's had work done by them independently from everything else.
Before I know, we were going to have them on as a guest.
Exactly, and has had great experiences. But we want to make sure that we can answer some of the listeners' questions from your questions regarding the ins and outs of the solar package, if you will, what you're going to put on your house, where it should go. Should it be a ground mount system, a roof mount system, a solar tracker, possibly the new solar shingles that are coming out, or some other type of methodology, and what do you need to look out for? So first and foremost, Marcus, welcome to the show. Good to have you.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah. How you doing today, sir?
Oh, I'm doing very well.
Excellent. So, I was talking to you yesterday about, the lead up to the show, and you had some really great input on what you would usually go through when you're heading to a site, to a new client. And I've found often that sometimes Vermonters are just looking at the item as it's just a one-off unit. Like, okay, I want a warmer house, a more efficient house, but they don't know the particulars about it. Or they may just go to the car dealership and I just want transportation, and they don't know the.
What are your actual goals, right?
What are your actual goals?
How do we refine when you show up on site what the goals are that the client has, and what have you run into, and how do you interact with that to get them more in line with the types of things that are possible?
Especially, Marcus, when we have some Vermonters who do a lot of research, and sometimes they will leave you saying, oh, what, climate panels? What are those? And so you've got to basically do your homework, stay on top of the latest that's going on in the industry. But how do you approach it when you come to a site and do your first vetting of a client?
Well, so of course it is a really quickly changing industry, and we have to keep up with all of the latest products, materials, and what is available out there. But one of the first things that I always do when I'm meeting with a homeowner is ask really what their main motivator or what their driving force behind going solar is. And if we can address what their needs are and what their wants are with the solar system, then we are more likely to be able to help them. And I tell a lot of people that really I'm more in education than I am in sales. I'm one of these solar advisors over there, even though I came from the installation team. But really, it's just more about the education. Solar very much kind of sells itself. It really does make a lot of sense in those scenarios. And discussing what exactly that homeowner is looking for, whether it's offsetting all of the electric bill and saving some money, or a fixed monthly payment, or just being a little bit greener, or a greater level of grid independence. There's really lots of ways to go about it and lots of things that we can do to kind of meet their goals.
So I'll jump in here. Hey, Marcus, it's been a couple of months since I've seen you, but it's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, hey, Chris.
How's it going? So I hired Green Mountain Solar to come out. Personally, as you guys have all heard before, I bought a raised ranch in 2010, and Jim and I super insulated it, made it super airtight, put it in an HRV, ERV. And the one thing I hadn't done to the house was make it net zero. So that was a goal for me. And I was able to take some equity out of my house and make that happen. And Marcus came over. We did a site visit. I didn't want to put solar panels on my roof. I have east and west facing roofs. And I didn't want to take the hit on the efficiency. So I did a ground-mounted system. And I needed to make it big enough to cover my entire yearly electric bill. So tell us a little about that, because it's obvious right now my solar system is not making enough power to cover my annual bill. How does that whole thing level out? How does that work?
So really the way that it works in Vermont is through a system called net metering. And so obviously the winters in Vermont here, the days get much shorter, the sun is much lower in the horizon, and we get plenty of snow. And so only about 10 to 20% of your annual production is coming from those winter months a lot of the time. And so really the idea behind net metering is that you want to size the system such that it actually overproduces in the spring, summer, and fall. And as you overproduce with your solar array, that excess production is going to go back to the grid. It actually spins your meter backwards, and your utility keeps track of it. And so essentially the idea is that you're building up the stockpile of excess credits throughout the spring, summer, and fall. And the idea is that you build up enough of these credits to last you through the winter months during times that the home is consuming more electricity than the solar can generate.
Now, Marcus, with the net metering, I know years ago when everybody started jumping on board and trying to get the solar panels, that VEC for a bit was saying no to the net metering because they'd had too much on their capacity. Is that still the case, or has
VEC, Vermont Energy Corp?
Yes.
Yep.
Co-op.
Co-op, right.
Yeah.
So Vermont Electric Co-op is very open to net metered solar applications now, as is Green Mountain Power, and those really are the two of the biggest players in the area. Mm-hmm. We also have Washington Electric Co-op, and then a host of probably 8 to 10 other smaller utilities throughout the state. And for the most part, they are all very welcoming to solar. And while solar does put it does put a little bit more stresses on the grid in certain applications, and so they are having to upgrade their substations and some transformers and being able to essentially update the grid for this newer type of power. And so when you file a certificate of public good with the Public Utility Commission, they essentially will let the utility know what size solar system is going in. They'll run the calculations to make sure that their infrastructure can handle it. And sometimes the homeowner who's going solar will actually have to pay for a transformer upgrade. But that is more on the personal level.
And one of the things Jim and I have been talking about for a long time whenever we talk about this particular topic is we want to electrify our grid, because the electrification of the grid allows for a lot of flexibility when you're not producing your own electricity, like at the power plant side. But a lot of the local grids are not up to the types of draws that we're looking for. So what you're saying is, if you were to put in a solar system in a house and that local grid was not up to it, it's kind of the moment where they get to upgrade that grid a little bit. Do I have that right?
Exactly. And so when you file a permit, if your transformer, your power pole can't handle the production from that array on the most productive day, they would request that the individual homeowner upgrade that transformer. And so once that transformer is upgraded, then that infrastructure can then handle that that solar generation. And so for most utilities, at least on residential side of things, they're usually very accepting of any size residential system that we could put in.
Now, it's my understanding, Marcus, going back to the net metering concept, is that there's the opportunity for the true friends and family discount, in the sense that if you have a site that has more room to produce more, that you can actually get enough of a credit and then gift that to a relative or somebody else you want to. Is that the case, that, as you understand it?
Yeah, you certainly can. So that's with a system called group net metering.
Mm-hmm.
And so for businesses going solar, or a lot of farmers who have multiple meters on site, or someone who's looking to kind of take on a solar endeavor with a friend, family member, or neighbor, you can actually upsize one system, so build one larger system that can account for multiple electric bills or multiple meters tied into one meter. And so you have the economies of scale. You're only doing one install. And then you can actually allocate that excess production from one meter to any other meter within the same utility.
Sure. Understood.
So you got to make sure that your friends and family live in the same utility, but beside that, that's an option. Interesting.
Exactly. And so for businesses who have multiple locations within the same utility, or farmers who have 4 or 5 meters on site and instead of building 4 or 5 systems can kind of take into account the consumption and all of those meters, size the system accordingly, and then allocate the percentages amongst the meters to allow all those meters to be offset with one system.
So this is – it's kind of like your own micro community setup.
Exactly.
Yep.
And what is nice about it is if you're paying for all of those meters, then you're directly getting the benefits. If you are sending to a friend or family member, you can either gift it. So essentially you're offsetting their electric bill now. You don't get directly paid for that, but you can set up some sort of gentleman's agreement where whoever's getting receiving those excess credits can then pay for however much electric bill offset they're getting.
What is the current compensation that the electric companies have to give you for a kilowatt hour that you produce?
So that's a little bit dependent utility to utility, but for Green Mountain Power right now, which is the largest utility in the state, the compensation rate is 15.4 cents for every kilowatt of solar production. And so that's for all of the excess production that's pushed back to the grid. Essentially, that comes from a blended residential rate, which is determined by Renewable Energy Vermont and by the Public Utility Commission. And there's a blended residential rate of 16.4 cents right now, and that typically changes biannually, so it goes up every 2 years to kind of follow the trend of utility rate increases.
Right.
So that there's that 16.4. Then there, right now there's a negative 1 cent siting adjuster, meaning you're credited one cent less.
Okay.
And that's just determined by the Public Utility Commission as well.
Okay, and with that, when you go to a site and you're looking at things, and Chris alluded to about this a little bit, where his preference was whether he was going to go with a rooftop system because of its orientation or a field-mounted system. And there's also, of course, the solar tracker system, which I know that they use about 5 to 10% of the energy they produce to track the sun, but you can get efficiencies of
30
and actually I've seen some to 45%. Some are reporting that. So, I mean, there are some benefits there. But I understood from talking to Paul not too long ago that the cost per kilowatt or per watt for the solar has dropped significantly from about $2 a watt to down to $1 a watt, and thus putting more solar panels out sometimes can be more cost effective.
In a fixed way, right?
In a fixed way, yes.
Right. Talk to us a little about that trade-off between a larger fixed array and a smaller tracker.
So if that's exactly correct. And so a tracker is obviously it's tracking the sun throughout the day to allow the optimal orientation and angle of incidence for the panels to maximize production. And so while a tracker is about 30 to 33% more efficient than a fixed ground-mounted system, even adding an extra 30% more panels on a fixed ground-mounted system is typically less expensive than a tracking system, at least in our experience.
And then you don't have moving parts that break, right?
Exactly. So now there's no moving parts. There's less conduit. There's less maintenance.
Sure.
On trackers, you need to do essentially a 10-foot-tall oil change every 3 to 5 years. And so the extra it really does make more sense to just kind of upsize a fixed ground-mounted system so it can really be the true kind of set-it-and-forget-it technology where you just install it, it just works, and you don't have to do anything other than really check the monitoring for the system.
Okay, well, right now, Marcus, we have a call from Roger and Sharon. So, Roger, welcome to the show, and what was your question?
And just a second. Just hang on the line there, Marcus. We're done with you. So, are we?
Yeah. No, we're not.
There we go. So, Roger and Sharon, how can we help you?
Hey, yeah. I've looked at solar power, and it always seems to say you need $20,000. So, that's one question. And when they gave me the thing, it said, well, you spend $110 a month, but your utility bill would be less. And I kind of shied away from it.
That's a very good question. It needs to make economic sense for you, right? If you're going to be installing a system that can be between $20,000 and $40,000 in order to cover all of your electric use, what's the payback on that? I think that Marcus has a very good answer to that. If he doesn't, then I'll jump in because I have a good answer for that. But I'll ask Marcus first. Marcus, what do you say to Roger?
Yeah, so I mean, the finances really do have to make sense. And while a lot of people want to do the right thing and want to be greener, if it's really hurting your wallet, then you're much less inclined to do so. And so really the way that we look to make solar make sense for the majority of homeowners in Vermont is instead of paying that monthly electric bill, which is always going to be there, it's really always going to increase. That's money that you're throwing away. It's money you're giving to the utility. You're never getting anything back on it. Really, the idea is essentially we set you up with a solar system that offsets 100% of your electric bill. And to finance that system through a solar loan, you then have a monthly payment for your solar loan, which could very often be very similar to your electric bill, sometimes even less, depending on the situation. And the idea is we're really replacing the electric bill with a solar loan. And then once that solar loan is paid off, you then own the system, and then you have free electricity, and it essentially eliminated your utility bill for the remainder of your years at the home there.
Yep.
So, Marcus, that segues nicely into some of the rebate monies that are out there. And I think Roger had a very good question on what is the average cost of a solar array when you have then coupled in with that any state and federal rebates or incentives. And then you look at the ROI, the return on investment. Where is that going to place most Vermonters in a 2,000 square foot home that may have a power bill somewhere between $110 and $140?
Whose goal is net zero, or whose goal is...
More so the return on investment, so to make sure that it's going to be paid for.
Right, just for sizing the system.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
So if we were to say, here's a family, they got a 2,000 square foot house, they're heating with oil, they're not planning on heating with electricity, they want to put in a system that will completely replace all their electrical, in those parameters, how would you answer Jim's question?
So essentially when we're sizing the system, it all has to do with their electric usage, right? So typically, if people have been living in that home, most utilities on the second page of their electric bill will show the last 2 years of electrical consumption or kilowatt hour consumption. And so what I like to do is I'll sit down with a homeowner. I will average their last 2 years of kilowatt hour consumption to find their annual consumption. Then from there, have the really important conversation with the homeowner of any major changes that they have planned, such as maybe switching over to heat pumps or an electric heating, as I know you guys were talking about that before, or switching over to an electric vehicle, because that's really kind of the direction that the world is going right now, is electrifying a lot of things. And so having that conversation with people for the changes that they're planning to make in the next few years, and then doing the calculations to then upsize the solar system to be able to offset those future changes as well. And so we have the monthly payment conversation, but then there's also the return on investment or payback period conversation as well. The average payback period in Vermont is right around 12 to 15 years for the average system, really depending on the situation. But as soon as you start offsetting the electric usage for heat pumps and electric vehicles, that conversation and that payback period becomes much more attractive. Because now you're offsetting not just your electric bill, but also your heating costs, your fuel oil costs, your gasoline costs from driving. And so when you start bringing those other pieces into the mix, then the ROI conversation becomes very interesting.
That happens to be where I was at. I heat with my electricity, and I also have an electric car. So that return on investment is very attractive from my point of view. And we have a call from Dick in Waterbury. Dick, how can we help you?
Hey, guys, how you doing?
We're doing well, thanks.
Good. This is an interesting conversation because in 2012, I installed a 7,500-watt solar system, roof-mounted solar system. when they came in and did my site survey, they gave me an estimate of around 10, 11 years of payback.
Okay.
And right now... my system has generated over $15,000 worth of electricity.
Wow.
Wonderful.
So your payback was much better than you were expecting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm in my 10th year right now, so, you know, it certainly has paid for itself.
That is great news. And have there been any hiccups along the way?
Nothing.
That's great.
Nothing at all. And I got a package where I can go online. I can track what's going on with the system. I can see immediately if there's any issues. And what I've done since I lived in my house now, since 95, I get to be kind of a spreadsheet nerd, I guess.
Are you taking your data and turning it into graphs?
I sure am.
Just don't suffer from analysis paralysis. You don't want to go too far.
But the interesting thing is I broke it down into every month, and in particular this year here, 2021, for total power generated, unfortunately, is going to be one of my worst years.
Interesting.
That just tells you, you know, something's going on. I've produced as many as 9,000 kilowatt hours in a 7,500 watt system.
Yep.
And this year I'm going to be, right around 7,800. So still at rated.
Yep.
Sure.
Yep.
But it'll be my lowest year so far.
Yeah, and of course, all of those year outputs and year production is going to be so dependent on what the weather does. You know, when do the leaves come? Do you have issues with how often is it cloudy? How often do you have snow blocking? I mean, there's so much in those numbers. But I, you know, I'm a data nerd myself, so Dick, I'm really glad you called.
and I also keep track. I can color code everything. So, for instance, in December of 2018, I installed a heat pump.
Okay.
And in August of 2020, I put in a heat pump water heater.
There you go.
Okay.
So I can look at every month and see what effect that power has had.
Sure.
And in 2021, I do use fuel oil, hot water baseboard, but I'll be about 125 gallons less of oil used this year.
And with oil as expensive as it's getting, that's a number.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So and I do have, when they did my survey, I've got a large maple tree that they estimated blocks about 15% of my total power.
Sure.
I've hesitated to take the thing down, but it's getting old and tired, and one of these days I may just have to.
Sure.
Then I'll see my numbers go up.
You would. You'd get that 15% back, and that would be an interesting thing to track as well.
Oh, for sure.
Well, Dick, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, and let us know how it goes if you do take that down.
Will do. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Hey, Marcus, another question I had for you, and this kind of dovetails off of what we were talking about for ROI or return on investment, is resale value of homes. Because we have found, and even shingle companies have geared their warranties to the fact that after doing the actuary studies, that most people don't stay in their homes after the 5 and 10 year mark. So if you may not get a payback until the 15, 12 year mark or whatever, someone may say, well, why would I want to invest in that? I'll probably just be moving, because people are very transitory in our society these days. But how does that translate that you've seen into the value of the home when somebody wants to market that?
So solar certainly does increase the value of your home. And if anything, it makes it a much easier home to sell, because Sure. Now you're selling a home that's essentially eliminated a utility that it would otherwise have. And so when selling a home, it's definitely easier to sell a home when it has solar because of that fact. But it also does increase the value of your home some. Some people will say a couple percentage points of the value of the home. Some people will tell you that it's about 50% value of the solar system. It is a really hard number to quantify. Even talking to real estate agents, it's very situational, really depends on the location, the house, the way the system's been built. But really, we've kind of seen in our own experience that 3 to 5 years, if you're buying a solar system and you get the 3 to 5 years of benefits and then you go to sell the home, that we've actually had a couple homeowners recoup their full investment and then some, having owned the system and lived in the house for 3 to 5 years, selling the home and recouping all of the money that they put into that.
Oh, that's great news. Definitely.
Yep.
So what have you seen as far as the longevity of the system? Because I do know that there is some degradation of the performance of the unit, but over the system over a time period. But what have you seen about the longevity of the current arrays, you know, silicone-based solar cells, photovoltaic arrays that are being produced today?
Yeah, so that's really where a lot of the technology has been improving over the last 10 years. And so obviously the cost for solar has gone down tremendously in the last 10 years, but the technology has also become much better. And so all panels degrade over time, as do most electronics.
Sure.
But it's really a matter of how quickly those panels degrade. And so, I mean, as a company, we're working primarily with companies like LG or REC or Hanwha Qcell, depending on the situation, whether it's roof or ground or what have you, But the panels that we work with, most of them have 25-year linear performance warranties. And so they're actually warranted and guaranteed to be at least 90% efficient 25 years down the road.
Okay.
And so that's not to say that they're going to fail at year 25. They degrade about 0.3% every year in a linear fashion.
Okay.
So even at year 40, they should be 85%+ productive.
Excellent. Excellent. And the ones that you sell the most of, do you see a monocrystalline or a polycrystalline, and what is the difference?
We're selling mostly monocrystalline panels. Okay. That's really kind of where the industry has gone. So it's all cut from essentially one cell. And
sure.
So that's really kind of the latest and greatest in the technology, and all the panels that we work with are that technology. We've also been seeing more bifacial panel technology as well. And so for our ground-mounted systems anyway, and carport structures, and that's very great technology as well. But unless you have some sort of reflective substrate below the panels, you're not going to get all that much excess production from a bifacial panel.
So bifacial, just to be clear, means that there's also a PV panel on the bottom that's taking reflective light and turning that into additional power.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
And I've seen those carports basically pop up around Vermont over the last 4 or 5 years. Could you explain a little bit more about that? And do you think that an entire house's load would be covered by what could be going on a simple two-car carport?
So a carport's very situational, just because our carports are typically engineered for 3 rows of 8 panels. So a typical two-car carport is a 24-panel system. And so unless it lines up fairly accurately with the usage, they're either going to be slightly undersized or slightly oversized. It's really kind of one production based on the location and the shade that there is and the orientation that there is.
Mm-hmm.
We can go do a 3-car carport, so 36 panels, or a 4-car carport with 48 panels. And so you really
then I got to buy another car. What are you doing to me here?
Exactly. So it's a little bit harder to tailor to an exact number if you're looking to offset an exact amount that you've done the research for.
Yeah, and that also is so dependent on what your loads are, what your usage is, right? I have a neighbor down the street. He's had solar panels up for a while, but he's still using oil for his heating. I'm doing everything, so my system is twice as big as his. But I'm completely covered from all my usage throughout the year. So it's not only site specific, but it's situational specific, right? What is it that you're trying to offset?
Exactly. And the other piece about carports, and while they are one of our most beautiful systems, arguably, they definitely are quite expensive. But you are really very much paying for the value of having the place to park your car, somewhere to put an electric vehicle charger, and then the 24 panels, obviously, as well.
Great. Well, we have another call. We're going to go back to our lines again. We have Scott in Colchester. Welcome to House Calls Vermont, Scott. And how can we help you today?
Oh, thank you. I've been getting ready and thinking about, you know, a solar array. And the number one priority for me is American-made. And I can't find anybody that American-made solar panels. And
that's a great question.
I don't
question.
Have any desire to enrich communist Red China anymore.
Well, I certainly understand that. Let's ask Marcus about solar panel production and where they're getting their panels from, and if there is a domestic or at least a non-Chinese panel on the market.
Sure.
Thank you.
So you're 100% correct. Most of the panels that we're working with are – so the primary panel we're working with really is this LG panel. The LG panels are manufactured primarily in Korea. But during when COVID first hit and we really were experiencing some serious supply chain issues, we were actually getting the panels that were manufactured in a facility in Alabama. And so LG has a manufacturing facility both in Korea as well as Alabama. We can't guarantee that the panels coming from one facility or the other. It really is picking of the straws there. We do have another panel, an REC panel, REC panel, which is made in Norway. And so you can definitely do some research to try to find a panel where it's manufactured in a place that you prefer. With that being said, though, we can't really guarantee that those LG panels are coming from the U.S. versus Korea.
Okay, but Korea, South Korea is a democracy, so and certainly not a part of communist China. So maybe I don't know, Scott, if that is something that you that would you know, give you the idea that you were getting a panel that wasn't going against your personal choices about where the panel should come from.
It's just frustrating to see wanting to spend trillions of U.S. dollars and not have a stipulation that stuff is made in the United States of America, and it's supposed to create jobs here. But, you know, buying solar panels from across wherever other than USA, I think Americans can do it. I was hoping that there would be some produced in the United States.
I think you have a great point. Thank you, Scott, and thank you for calling.
Yes.
I think you bring up a very good point. Is there has not been a corporation in the United States that has really invested in creating PV panels here, and that's true of a lot of manufacturing. There's a lot of things of products that we're buying that are ostensibly made in America, a lot of car parts, a lot of things like that, and we're certainly getting them assembled in America, but a lot of those actual parts are not made inside the U.S. It becomes pretty complicated when you want to know where every little bit is coming from, and I certainly do support the setting up of a domestic photovoltaic production company that would be not only producing and putting the panels together like Marcus was saying was happening at the LG plant in Alabama, but in actually having the photovoltaics themselves produced here. But that's really one of those, you know, when is a company going to step up and do that kind of question?
Well, some of the challenges have been, too, is what the current technology requires for manufacturing. What are the materials? A lot of them are supply chain dependent. A lot of them are rare earth materials, and some countries have those in great supply, some don't. And so a lot of times they'll move the manufacturing points to those.
To be close to the source.
Exactly.
Of the
one technology, though, that is emerging, Marcus, you know, there are a different type of panel. It's going to be basically one that it's been out since 1999 that they've been doing, but they've been able to increase the
– He's going to say the P word.
The P word. Oh, no. perovskite panel. The perovskite. Perovskite panel. Basically, though, that they're – it's more flexible. It takes about 20% of the materials to produce.
Higher outputs.
It has higher outputs. Yeah, the efficiency had gone from 1999, or actually 2006, they had gotten it up to 4%, and now it's approaching 28 to 29%.
Yep.
But it's not perfect because there's some durability issues that they're trying to overcome, but that technology is emerging. The nice thing about it is it's able to be manufactured out of readily available, domestically located materials.
Basically, you can print these onto substrates that are flexible. So that's a very exciting development in technology that we're hoping to learn a lot more about as they become commercially available. But right now, Marcus, if I'm not mistaken, there are no perovskite panels available commercially on the market.
There are not at least that I've heard of.
Yeah.
It's really just the standard photovoltaic panels that we have now.
Emerging technology for sure.
Yep. And Marcus, we are coming up on the end of the show, but the one thing I talked to you about yesterday that we have seen so often is after somebody does this whole home retrofit for weatherization and everything else where they had been shivering at 55 degrees in the house with only a few warm spots that they could huddle around, now they might be going around in shorts and stocking feet and they have the temperature up at 72, 73 degrees, and they say, we're not saving as much as we thought because the behavioral change, that sigh of relief, like, now we can relax a bit, comes into play. What have you seen on that side that now people think, I've got my solar array?
Let me turn everything on.
What have you seen with that?
So we definitely see a little bit of that, people increasing their usage a little bit after going solar when people are having the feeling that, or when people are producing all of their power from the panels on their roof, they don't feel as bad about leaving the lights on or maybe having the heat pump stay a couple degrees warmer in the winter or a couple degrees cooler in the summer, and just have being a little more comfortable and not feeling as bad about that. And so when we have that conversation, we typically, when we're doing these offset conversations, I always recommend erring on the side of being slightly oversized versus compared to their current electrical consumption or even what the plans are in terms of growing their electric usage.
Mm-hmm.
And I always recommend erring on the side of being slightly oversized to give them the flexibility to use all of their loads in their house as they would like, and to really allow them to use their heat pumps and their electric vehicle to the fullest extent that they would like to when they have the solar.
Okay, the last question I have for you, because we are short on time, is what happens if Joel and Cy, they're just turned off all the power, but because we lost power here and we had the solar PV array, what would a customer expect? So what are their options if you just totally lose power and you're not generating electricity because it's at night and everything else? What are you going to do in this case if you have a PV array? What do you guys offer at Green Mountain Solar?
So we would offer a battery backup system of some sort, so it would still be a grid-tied system. And so now when the power goes out, with current technology, when the power goes out, your panels actually shut off, mainly for the safety of power line workers.
Yes.
But if you have a battery backup, the battery essentially becomes the brains of the operation. The battery would switch over to provide backup. It's very similar to a whole home generator. It is an instant transfer. You actually don't even see the lights flicker. It's silent. It's fossil-free and can provide you backup for either all of the appliances in your home or just the critical loads in your home to really give you that peace of mind during an outage. And also the flexibility of if the power does go out, now your panels will still work when you have a battery backup as well.
Yep, great.
And so we work with primarily the Tesla Powerwall, but also the Enphase Ensemble batteries as well. And they a lot of details going into the two of them and a lot of different programs, and they each have their own pros and cons.
Well, that's great, Marcus, and we thank you so much for being here. This was basically something that, because of, once again, Paul Azure's commitment to the industry, yours as well, that's why we wanted to have you on as an educational piece. But now here's a time for a shameless plug. If somebody wants to go ahead and get some solar done, have their site evaluated, whatever, how would they get a hold of you or somebody at Green Mountain
Solar
the best?
So if you just want to send an email, if you're looking into solar, you'd send an email to Green Mountain Solar, so info@greenmtnsolar, or give our office a call, 802-365-7190, and you can call there, and someone will answer the phone and talk about exactly what you're looking for, and then set you up with a solar site evaluation with either myself or one of my colleagues to then have an hour-long solar site evaluation conversation to discuss your goals, and then we pull together a proposal based on our conversation, and we do all of these services for free. So we'll design a system and pull together a proposal and some numbers for you for your review for free, and so we'd be happy to do that if anyone's interested.
Great.
That's great.
Well, thank you so much, Marcus, for taking time out on your Saturday to talk to us. Have a good rest of your weekend. And for the rest of you, next week.
Yes, it's rumored.
We are going to have the Matt Clark from Northern Basin Systems as a guest. And we'll be talking about basements. We were talking about ABCs, right? Last week, we've been talking about indoor air quality. And one of the places that's often overlooked and can have a huge effect on your indoor air quality is what's going on in that basement of yours.
Or the basements, because there's so many different
basements, crawl spaces.
How everything's attached, the dark, scary spaces where you keep small animals that you don't – anyway. But definitely it's a great –
I don't keep my children in the basement. What are you talking about?
Only if they're not behaved. But anyway, so with that, we thank you for being here today. Hopefully this was informational. You can always go to our website.
Housecallsvt@gmail.com. And if you're interested and haven't yet – not yet signed up for the indoor air quality survey, send us an email there and we'll get you on the list.
And I'm Jim Bradley, and this is
Chris West. Until next week, this is House Calls Vermont. Have a good week.
Thanks.
House Calls Vermont has been brought to you by RK Miles, a third generation family owned business, proud to be your local buildings material supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years, known for anything construction, big or small jobs, one call does it all. POLLIConstruction.com. Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor, 802-793-2002. By Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. by Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. By Shamrock Painting. That's right, painting and custom wood finishing. ShamrockPainting.com. By Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems for all things basement-y. NorthernNEFoundations.com. And by WIFA Windows, high-performance passive house windows and doors. They're online at WYTHEWindows.com. Be sure to join us next Saturday at 12:30 during the noon hour for House Calls Vermont on WDEV.